Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It seems like feast or famine when it comes to precipitation lately. For several months, two-thirds of New Hampshire has been labeled in moderate drought, and the top third of the state listed as abnormally dry. But now a wet week is forecast for the Granite State, with heavy rains predicted for some areas, and those extreme events can be just as problematic as drought. So in these up-and-down conditions, how do communities respond, protecting water resources for drinking, for farming, for recreation, and more? That's what we're asking today in the Exchange. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests for the hour. Stacy Herbold is here, State Water Conservation Chief with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Stacy, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura. I appreciate being here.
Also with us, Brian Goetz, Deputy Public Director of Works for the City of Portsmouth. And Brian, good to have you too. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And also with us, Annie Ropeek, NHPR reporter on energy, environment, and development. And Annie, thanks again for helping us out. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
So, Annie, is New England getting drier or wetter? Because we keep seeming to go back and forth on this.
Yeah, so wetter overall, that's the long-term trend. So we've had a couple studies out of Dartmouth and UNH in the past several years that say over the past century, there's been more precipitation overall and more extreme precipitation events, and that trend should continue as the climate warms. So that New England's climate change story is basically warmer summers, more extreme precipitation events, so that's a big dump of rain in a short period of time, and many more inches of precipitation a year overall. So we're going to see more ups and downs, but overall it's going to be getting wetter.
So that's what we're seeing then, ups and downs, because I remember that forecast in 2014, I think it was, from UNH, a big study that predicted a wetter, more sort of tropical future for New England, tropical in quotes, obviously.
Our version, exactly.
Which
is hot and muggy and wet. Yeah. Still. I mean, no small difference.
So, but then we saw a big drought in 2016, major drought in 2016. Not significant, but still a moderate drought for this year. So it made me kind of wonder, Annie, hang on, what happened to that wet future?
Yeah, I mean, so this is one of the examples of the extremes that we're going to see. So warmer temperatures can cause drought. A warmer summer changes the growing season. You know, you can have long spells where there's no rain, and then all of a sudden you have a ton of rain. But that doesn't necessarily offset a drought once it's set in. It doesn't go away immediately just because it rains. So we've seen it raining a lot in the past several days, but we are still technically in drought because it's not so much about just how much water, you know, hits the ground. It's about how much soaks into the ground, those aquifers that are underground, and sort of the longer term conditions and the ability of people and of plants to use that water and to sort of feel like they are in long term wet conditions. And so
it's interesting.
So the drought may wane eventually. You know, we may end up having sort of a wet spell or like even little sort of a monsoon season, which is kind of what it feels like right now. But so, you know, it's not that droughts aren't going to be possible. It's more about these extremes. And so you're going to see those on both sides, even as we tend toward higher precipitation overall.
Well, it's interesting to hear you, Annie, talk about sort of what we mean by a drought and what it takes to alleviate a drought. So, Stacy, for the official definition of a drought, what is it? And are we still in one?
So drought, the definition of drought can be fairly complicated, but just to make it easy and narrow it down, it's basically below average precipitation over an extended period of time. So in New Hampshire, we look at 1 month to years. And how that low precipitation is impacting stream flows, groundwater, and soil moisture. So below average stream flows and groundwater levels, which is important for people to understand. As I get a lot of questions, we got rain today. What does that mean for the drought? And as Annie was mentioning, it really depends on the conditions out there. How much rain are we getting at once? If it's dumping rain out, that may help replenish our streams and rivers and surface waters. But if it's hitting the ground hard and just running off, it's not replenishing our groundwater supplies necessarily. If it's really hot out, then there's a lot of evaporation. Also, we're at peak growth season, so the trees are sucking up a lot of water. So it's really looking at inputs and outputs, and how much water are we taking in, how much is going out into the system, so that whole water cycle. And I think it's also important to note that about 40% of our population is on their private wells, which is groundwater. So, well, some of the larger systems out there, like Brian will talk about, who are on surface waters, also have backup wells in place. Those on private wells don't have the luxury of having a large water system managing their resource for them. So it's very important that while they may see rain, they continue to conserve water at their homes. We saw hundreds of people's wells go dry back in 2016, and we also saw the drought become more severe as the summer went on into October. If you're waiting till September or October to start conserving, you're a little late in the game.
Yeah. So, well, it's really interesting what you said, and definitely going to ask Brian about surface waters and public water supplies. But the significance of people on private wells, Stacey. So just remind us how that's set up in New Hampshire, because I think it's a little bit different.
Sure. In New Hampshire, we have public water systems, which are community water systems such as municipalities. The city of Portsmouth has its own water system. We have large public water systems like Aquarion or Penichuk. And those systems, including any small system that serves 25 people or more, are considered community water systems. They have their own water systems. They manage their own water systems. There's a permitting process through the state they go through to ensure they have enough capacity to serve the people that are on the system. But then we have the private wells. So we have people all over the state on their own private wells. These larger systems don't extend to them, so they rely on their own wells for water. And it's up to them to maintain those wells. It's up to them to test their own wells and to know about what type of well they have.
And are they particularly vulnerable to drought conditions, people on private wells?
I would say that it depends on your well. You could be very fortunate and have a high producing well, but I would say they are more vulnerable because, like I said, the larger systems have alternate sources. They have more than one well. They may have a surface water and a well in place. And their staff watching the water levels every day, whereas a private homeowner just pretty much has the news and weather to go on.
Well, and Brian, how obsessively do people like you watch water conditions like droughts, like coming rain? Are you, you know, how many weather apps do you have on your phone?
Continuously. From the public water system perspective, we deal with two things, basically, quantity and quality. And with respect to quantity, the two things we deal with are supply and demand. So we're always tracking supply. We've got very good records. When you look at a water system like the city of Portsmouth, it's been in operation over 200 years. And ironically, 100 years ago, they started keeping very good records, metering all sources, metering all customers. So we have a very good 100-year record of past use and consumption. And of late, we've developed tools. We have much more, capability of Googling information, getting USGS information on groundwater levels, getting NOAA information on weather patterns, and then tracking just what, the past has done, the recent past.
So what are you seeing looking at that sort of treasure trove of data?
Well, the treasure trove of data says that, and I would say, in addition to the climate change issues, this is New England. So I've been 20 years managing water systems in New England, and every year is different. And I would expect the next 20 years will continue to be different. You can't set up any pattern that seems to totally repeat itself other than we have cycles. And most recently, we had a very you know, dry, beautiful summer weather cycle here the last 2.5 months or so. Now we seem to be in a tropical wet cycle, which means, you know, we get some storms coming in, which is good. Doesn't necessarily replenish supply, but what it does is people that have started to irrigate, they're afraid their green lawn's going to go brown, which is just dormant. They, you know, start using the water. We, you know, try to message about being efficient, but, you know, demands go up. And that's what we saw, you know, up until, you know, last week, we saw our demands ever increasing. We were getting word out about, you know, the fact that if it stayed dry, we would have to put restrictions on,
so
and then the rains came.
Let me just jump in. So do you have water restrictions right now in Portsmouth? Or you, it sounds like you were on the brink of asking people
to
conserve.
In 2016, same story, only in 2016, it continued to be very hot and dry. We did have a fairly wet spring, which was very helpful to us. So
is Portsmouth still in a drought?
Yes, we're still behind. You know, behind normal as far as precipitation. But again, we had a very good spring. We had snows this winter that soaked in the ground. There's so many variables, as Stacy said, to, you know, the supply side that, you know, we track things and we know we're in better shape than we were 2 years ago.
Annie, go ahead.
So, Brian, you and Stacy both were at this meeting that the state held last week, or someone from Portsmouth was there, about the drought, and that's something that happens, I guess, once a drought has been sort of sustained, the state sort of calls everyone in and says, okay, this is happening, what are we going to do about it? And one thing that I thought was really interesting that came up at that meeting was that our aquifers and our groundwater supplies are just a lot smaller scale and shallower than ones in the West, say. And so they're more susceptible to large extremes like this. You know, it doesn't take as much to sort of affect them. So I wondered if you could talk about that a little, Stacey.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I did see that as well. So I'm glad you brought that up, Annie, that even though, you know, New Hampshire looks so wet, I mean, beautiful lakes and, you know, everywhere you turn, there's a stream or a river or a pond or something. Annie's right. I have read that our water resources might be more vulnerable. Go ahead, Stacey.
Yes, definitely New Hampshire could be more vulnerable, especially when it comes to drought. You may have heard that Dixie Cup comparison before, that in New Hampshire, we just our groundwater is in the bedrock, so fractures in the bedrock. So if you think about when you're driving down the highway and you see those big bedrock faces that they've blasted out and you see water trickling down, that is what if you opened up your well and looked at a side profile of it, if you have a bedrock well, what that would look like. And water stored in all those fractures. So in New Hampshire, we don't have this huge necessarily reservoir. We have areas where there's some unconsolidated materials above the bedrock, but that's also very shallow. So those are where dug wells are, which is why sometimes dug wells respond to drought much more quickly. That water at the top of above the bedrock depletes much quicker than down in the bedrock.
So it dries up more quickly?
Yes,
is that what you're saying?
It dries up more quickly. And then the bedrock wells respond later on often. And the bedrock wells are also the ones that take longer to replenish. And so if you think about fractures, that's a little, just a little Dixie cup of water. And even our reservoirs compared to out west are much smaller. Ours are more meant for recreation. We are able to use them to let some water out to control stream flows, but it's nothing like out west. So we just have this small area of supply.
Let me remind our listeners that you can join us. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're looking at water management in a time of drought and then heavy rain. We're looking at how New Hampshire is protecting water resources and preparing for these types of feast or famine cycles with precipitation. And let's get your thoughts, questions, comments. You can send us an email. What are you seeing in your community in terms of drought or sometimes excessive water? exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Talking about groundwater, I think this is harder for people to wrap their heads around. You know, you see surface water in Concord. We've got the reservoir and you can drive by it or bike by it or whatever. But what about groundwater? I'll turn to you first. Brian, what does it mean to sort of recharge the groundwater and have a healthy source of groundwater?
Well, it's simply, you know, the precipitation has an opportunity to go in the ground, and what doesn't end up in a stream, you know, is stored in these aquifers, both the bedrock and surficial. It's called sand and gravel aquifers, which the city of Portsmouth has for the most part. Some big water sources that are groundwater. And again, like being able to look at a rain gauge, we have groundwater gauges essentially. And in the old days, you had to go out and you dropped a, you know, essentially a plumb bob down your well, and you said how deep was the water, and you would track that. Well, right now we have all the eight wells that we have that are active wells on the supply have real-time data. So we could look right now, pull it up, the water operators know what the water level is. That has an indication of how much water is still in the aquifer and the ability of that well to, you know, produce. And if, you know, we see where one well might be being over-tapped a bit, we can cut back on that and shift to other ones. And again, you know, the long-term trend of these and having the backup data, knowing where we stand, helps predict the future. Because, you know, the thing about a drought is, you know, it comes on slowly. It's not an emergency like a hurricane. So you do have time to prepare. And if you have groundwater sources, they just don't go away overnight. But if you're tracking trends and, you know, predicting based on your past experience, you can get the word out that, you know, things might be such that people need to cut back on their use.
It's easier to see, though, when you have like a public reservoir. You can see the levels going down. You can see, you know, it looks kind of small or it looks kind of dry. But with groundwater, Stacy, right, you can't really tell that it's not there until all of a sudden it's not there.
Right. Makes it difficult. And like you said, people look around and they see water everywhere. And even if stream levels decrease or even when lakes decrease, people may still not notice. The only telltale signs are the water lines along the lake, or if you're familiar with a stream or river, then you definitely can tell that the stream levels or lake level is lowering. But the groundwater levels are just, you can't see them. So unless you have the technology, like Brian was saying, for his larger water system, then it's very difficult to know what your levels are in your well, except your experiences in the past. So during the last drought, did my well go dry? And even that isn't a great gauge.
Well, and you touched on this earlier, Brian, so I'm going to go to you first, but I want to hear from everybody. How much do people waste water here in New Hampshire, given, again, how beautifully wet we seem to be? It seems to rain a fair bit, except for this most recent drought. We've got all these beautiful lakes and rivers and streams and ponds and so forth. You mentioned people watering their lawns, worrying if their lawns go brown. You said, don't worry about it. How much do we waste water here in New Hampshire?
Wasting, I would think, you know, relative to, I know Stacy talked about the Western states, people really irrigate out west. I managed a water system in Utah for 4 years, and in the summer, demand would go up 10 times. We don't see 10 times the water demand here. It goes up 50%, maybe doubles. But, you know, what you see is, and I've witnessed this myself, when it rains now, people cut back, at least in our system, the messaging that's gone out. I mean, people don't want to pay for water they don't need. They do see it on their water bills, and certainly, you know, getting that bill every month. If you've irrigated a lot last month, you're going to say, well, wait a second, am I really needing all this water? So, you know, as far as waste, you know, we don't see that near like it used to be 10, 15 years ago. Again, it's a factor of, you know, people are understanding more, you know, how to wisely use water, but also if they're paying for it, they're going to try to hold back because, you know, there's no greater incentive than to disincentivize people from having to pay so much for water.
We'll talk a lot more after a short break. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
What car would you buy with $25,000? If you're the grand prize winner of NHPR Summer Car Raffle, the choice is up to you. You could go with something practical, fuel efficient, or get something with a little muscle.
Guess you better slow your Mustang down.
But don't wait, we're picking the lucky winner this Saturday at 2 p.m. Get in on the fun for as little as $50 or get 6 tickets for $150. The more you buy, the better the deal at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, managing water resources in New Hampshire in a time of drought and also extreme rain. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We have three guests. Annie Ropeek is with us, NHPR reporter on energy, environment, and development. Brian Goetz, Deputy Director of Public Works for the City of Portsmouth, and Stacey Herbold, State Water Conservation Chief with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Stacey, just before the break, I was asking Brian how much he thinks people here in New Hampshire waste water, waste being, you know, maybe a subjective term. I wonder what you think, given, again, that we've got this rich visual water resource anyway, lakes and streams and so forth. Do we tend to waste water here?
Yes, we do waste water. I think we do a pretty good job at conserving water, but we also have many more opportunities to save water. And a good example, I created this 93-gallon jug pyramid. They're milk jugs in a pyramid that we put out at different outreach events and have people guess what that amount of water represents. And it represents the average amount of water per capita used in New Hampshire in the summer months. And so people look at it and they say, there's no way I can use that much water. And it is average per capita, so about 30 of those gallons goes towards outdoor water use, with the 63 remaining the indoor. So you'd say that 63 is, you know, your year-round indoor water use. But the 30 in the summertime, science has shown that about 50% of that can be wasted due to inefficient watering practices and just inefficient uses of water outdoors in general.
What are those? What's an inefficient watering practice? Like, don't water your flowers at noon?
Yes. Pretty much you should be watering just enough. And what is just enough?
Right.
If you're guessing, then you're probably not watering just enough. So if you're using an irrigation system, there are smart irrigation controllers out there now that use soil moisture sensors, rain shutoff gauges, weather to look at evapotranspiration rates, temperature, precipitation to know how much water your lawn really needs. And also not watering in the middle of the day. Watering in the middle of the day, evaporation rates are high. When temperatures are high, the air can hold more water. So if you're watering in the middle of the day, a lot of what you're watering with is going to evaporation.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Okay.
Yes. And then even just outdoor water use in general, if you don't have a nozzle on the end of your hose and you're just letting it run, spraying it on your car, washing down your car, that hose wastes about 8 gallons per minute as you allow it to run. So there's lots of little things. People are becoming a lot more conscious about how they're using water, especially because some of them are paying for it. Private well users know there's a chance of a shortage. But there are little things that over time that it just is a culture shift. So we were talking about brown lawns and, okay, it may be okay to water your lawn when we have plenty of water, but when we're in the midst of drought, do we need to be watering lawns? Well, not necessarily. The lawn can go dormant. It'll pop back when there's rain. So in terms of sometimes people talk about hierarchy of needs, or basically what we want to focus on is making sure people have drinking water.
Right, sure. I mean, anybody would agree that's at the top of the hierarchy. It is interesting, this cultural shift, though, that Stacey talks about, Annie. I remember in the drought in 2016, and we did a fair bit of coverage of this, you know, people would call and say, my lawn is proudly brown, but my neighbor is, you know, out there watering all the time. It's a lush green. You can walk on it in your bare feet. I mean, it is sort of a cultural shift, and everybody has different values. I mean, I've got my flower garden, and I'm going to water it.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up with like a beautiful, pristine lawn. I mean, my mom's going to hate me. I know she's listening and she's going to hate me for saying that. The lawn looks great. But I guess what I'm saying is that we didn't need to water it in order for it to look like a fine, normal lawn. And I just have never honestly really understood that practice. But I understand that people want their homes to look beautiful and you're allowed to do that, obviously. But Brian, could you explain what you meant by dormant? Because I don't actually really understand that. What does it mean when your lawn goes brown? Is it dead or can it come back?
Generally, a lawn goes brown, but you still have the base, you still have the roots and everything. And when you get a bunch of water again, it's gonna go green. It goes dormant, just like the trees drop their leaves in the fall. Of kind of the basic thing, the leaves come back next year. One thing to add to what Stacy said, at the City of Portsmouth for a public water system, we have abilities to, implement restrictions and efficiency. And one of the things the city council recently adopted a couple years ago on people have irrigation meters on our system, people that want to have irrigation meters now have to have WaterSense certified. So WaterSense program is an EPA program that they developed a number of years ago to promote water efficiency and to put standards out and guidelines for systems to follow. And so basically what that is if people now want to put an irrigation meter into, their water service, they have to have it certified by an irrigation provider that uses WaterSense. So essentially that is, like Stacy says, you have, the system is designed only to water enough for the lawn, has controllers,
efficient as possible. It's like a smart meter almost.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Let's go to our listeners. Lots of people calling in, emailing with their questions and comments and observations about the cycle of drought, and now we seem to be in a wetter cycle, how that's affecting our water use and our thoughts and attitudes about water. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Tell us what's happening in your community. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Peter in Keene says, I consider it wasteful that we as a society use drinking water to flush toilets and water grass. Is there any movement toward gray water reclamation? And Peter, it's a great question. And Stacy, I'm looking at you. This is something that has come up time and time and time again. And whenever we do shows on water management, I feel guilty when I flush the toilet. I mean, this beautiful, clean drinking water. Is anybody looking at using so-called gray water for those uses that need to be less than pristine?
Using gray water is catching on. I can't say that it's anywhere close to like it is out west, where the demand on water supplies is much higher and the supplies there is much less. But one thing we are seeing a lot of, we have a handful of golf courses in the state that are reusing treated wastewater to water their golf courses. I believe we have one ski mountain that has a permit to use gray water. I don't believe they're using it yet, but they can rely on it if necessary in the future. We have new developments, new buildings that get LEED certification in the state.
LEED certification is, just remind us.
LEED certification is a certification that it's environmental and energy conservation. So you get a certain amount of points for maybe how water efficient you are, how energy efficient you are.
I had no idea that included water efficiency. I've always thought of that as energy efficiency.
Me too. But I thought it was light bulbs and so forth.
Yes. Yeah, so interestingly, people get the most points. It seems in New Hampshire they go the energy side most of the time. The gray water reuse doesn't get a lot of attention. And efficiency often comes through putting in water rain collection systems, which is a great means of water efficiency too, if they want to water their business's front lawn.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned some of these bigger users, because we've been talking more about the individual, either that person on a well who needs to keep a close eye on it, or that person who might be on a public water system, but you guys are encouraging them to conserve too. Annie, who are some of the big users of water?
Yeah, so I was just looking at this chart from the State Department of Environmental Services from a few years ago, and it actually says that our public water supply is by far the biggest user. So, I mean, there are states out there where industrial uses or agricultural uses are far and away the biggest water users, but that's not the case in New Hampshire. I mean, industry does follow sort of in second place after public water supply, but that's because industrial uses of water are just going to be larger scale kind of by their nature, but we don't have as many of those here as other sort of more manufacturing heavy states do. And then agriculture and aquaculture also, you know, are lower down on the list just because they're not quite as large of industries here. And same for mining. That's another one that, you know, in some states uses a lot of water. And New Hampshire is, you know, just not a state that is funneling giant amounts of water into those kinds of industrial practices. It's just mostly your home and your business and your town water use that makes up the bulk of it.
Yeah, and I can see that, you know, we're not a huge farming state like Iowa or Indiana, but I hadn't thought about mining. My goodness, never thought of mining using a lot of water.
Yeah, just, I mean, anything industrial or where you have to wash things off or blast things with water or use water to manufacture some item or anything like that or irrigate a field, those are going to be huger amounts of water even just for one little, you know, a smaller scale sector of that nature. But our sectors of those kinds are smaller enough here that it doesn't quite have as much of an impact.
Well, a little bit later, we'll hear from one fruit farmer here in New Hampshire who has had some issues with the recent drought. So that'll be coming up in about 10 minutes. Let's go back to our listeners. Peter, by the way, thank you for that question about gray water. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And up next is Jody from Cambridge. Hi, Jody. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about the runoff waters in March and April that we have been getting lately, which are flooding basements, especially my basement, because we don't have any place to put the water at that time of year when the grounds are frozen. Is there a plan or is there anything that we can do to help protect our basements?
Well, sure, and runoff is a huge issue and becoming more and more so, Jody, you're right, because we see extreme precipitation events where you get lots and lots of rain in a short period of time. There have been a couple efforts aimed at this, and Brian, I wonder if you want to tackle that one first, sort of slowing down, sucking up these huge runoffs that we've been seeing that get into people's basements, as our caller says.
That's a tough one. I think it's more
we spent whole site, hours on that topic,
site specific.
By the way, so.
I would say, you know, even I think of my own house. If you're in New Hampshire, likely your house is built maybe near a lot of ledge, a lot of rock, so it's more of a drainage issue there, and you know where all that water is spread out. I mean, a house itself is a collector of water when you have roof drains and that, so you have to redirect the roof drains, try to get them further away from the house. And, you know, if you could capture some of that water, it'd be great. We have a program in Portsmouth that was implemented a few years ago, and people got rain barrels at cost, and they were just hugely popular. And we still have to this day a bunch of people thanking us for the rain barrel they were able to get. They use it all the time. They collect that 55 gallons when it rains. They can use that. So things like that. I mean, it's kind of a plumbing thing. It's that in that respect. Back to the secondary system. I mean, this is something that
the gray water question.
The gray water question. I mean, certainly Paul Suska at DES has coined the phrase the purity paradox. You know, so we're running public water, and we can't differentiate whether someone's drinking the water, whether they're using it to irrigate, whether they're using it to flush a toilet. So every drop of that water has to be pure and drinkable, and if it's not, we have to inform our customers of that. But the other thing that large public water systems do is, Portsmouth, for example, we have two power plants, so even in the winter, they're making a lot of energy. They're using that water for cooling. We have gypsum manufacturers that use a lot of it in their process.
Oh, so large water
and,
users like Annie was talking
about.
Yeah,
and big buildings have cooling systems, and those cooling systems use a lot of water as well. So we've been reaching out to all those customers as far as, you know, any opportunity they might have internally to be more efficient. And they, too, are trying to take steps to be more efficient with their water in that
and
respect.
Possibly use gray water for those purposes,
yeah,
Brian?
That's also kind of a plumbing code thing. I mean, you got to be very careful with gray water because you have to make sure that you know, if you're using that secondary source, that it's not going to be consumed. So, you know, you get more into plumbing codes and, you know, being careful about, you know, making sure that tap is hooked to the public water if it's going to be, you know, the drinkable water.
You don't want to throw the wrong switch and have somebody drinking gray water. Annie, I'm really glad that Jody called about this runoff issue because this is sort of the flip side of the drought question. It's these extreme precipitation events. And she's right. When you have all this rain all at once, it gets into your basement. It also can cause contamination in your local lake or pond. What steps or policies have communities or the state taken to try to slow the flow of these big runoffs?
Yeah, the flooding comment is really important. I mean, as we see more extreme precipitation events, those big dumps of water in a short period of time, flooding is really the main concern that those cause. I mean, you know, muddy rivers and stormwater runoff are one thing, and our systems need to be designed to handle those. But, you know, a lot of people in low-lying areas, especially on the seacoast, are going to see more of that water getting into their basements. And the caller's right that, you know, sometimes you don't know what to do with that water. Like, how do you get it out of your house? That costs money. It takes infrastructure. And it has an effect on stormwater and on contamination, potentially, you know, things it brings up into your basement. So all of these things are things towns are going to need to be thinking more about. And the question of how to handle runoff is really one that towns have to answer. And the state has put up a lot of money for water upgrades to pipe infrastructure and, you know, making systems be less leaky. That was one of the big grants we saw for, I think it was Colebrook, got one of the state's first drinking and groundwater trust grants. And that's just something the state's going to be chipping away with, I think. You are seeing a lot of towns talking about now, but I don't know that there have been a ton of large-scale statewide changes to sort of reckon with that yet.
Stacey, go ahead.
DES does have a program called Soak Up the Rain, and basically they will go out to the smaller properties. So if you're a homeowner with a drainage issue, they can go out, staff will go out and assess your property, see what opportunities for slowing down that storm water there are on your property, whether it be a rain garden, a dry well, or just kind of directing the storm water to a wetland. At my own house, I live on the seacoast. We have a lot of ledge on our property. Having the same problem, our basement floods. We made some changes to our house. It created a worse problem, and now we're trying to figure out where do we put this water? There's a ledge. Do we blast through the ledge to put the water further back on our property? And our solution has been a rain garden and then putting dry wells, or big holes basically in your yard filled with loose stone, and then you cover it back up. The water gathers in there and then it slowly percolates out.
Wow, I'd love to look at that.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually.
It's still under construction. But we're hiding one of the dry wells as a fire pit. So it's interesting how, you know, over the top is this gravel-looking fire pit, but it's acting as a dry well.
So give the name of the program again for Jody, who's concerned about this on her own property.
Soak Up the Rain.
Yeah.
Stacey, can I ask how much that's cost?
This isn't part of the Soak Up the Rain project. This is our own project, and I really don't have the numbers yet. Our yard is literally torn up right now, so we're doing a little bit at a time. But it's the dry well and the rain garden you could do for fairly inexpensively if you had, you know, if you're doing the work yourself, had a truck to bring in the gravel. If you're doing it at a larger scale, it's obviously going to cost more money.
Well, and I'm so glad, Jody, you called, because the flip side, again, of this drought problem is these extreme events and lots of runoff all at once that causes all sorts of problems, contamination, and for properties like Jody's. So thank you, Jody, for the call. We'll take a lot more of your calls after a short break. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about water management today in The Exchange. Also coming up, we'll hear from one local fruit farmer who has been dealing with drought. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, or later on Thursday, we'll go back to our summer series, Going Local, with a look at the White Mountains. You can visit nhpr.org/exchange to submit your thoughts about the region. That's Thursday on The Exchange. Again, it's our summer series, Going Local, and this week it's going to be the White Mountains. This hour, we're looking at how we prepare ourselves for drought conditions and then heavy rain, both of which stress our water resources. Let's hear from you on this. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We have three guests. Stacy Herbold is here, State Water Conservation Chief with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Brian Goetz, Deputy Director of Public Works for the City of Portsmouth. And Annie Ropeek, NHPR reporter on energy, environment, and development. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. With us now is Chuck Suther. He's owner of Apple Hill Farm in Concord. He's been dealing with these water conditions for some time. Chuck, really nice to have you. Thank you for your time. Chuck, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us. What crops, first of all, do you grow, Chuck, in addition to apples? The name Apple Hill Farm makes it obvious that you grow apples, but what else do you have?
What we tell people is we grow tree fruit, which includes apples, peaches, plums, pears. We grow small fruit, strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, currants, and a wide variety of vegetables.
Wow. So how has the moderate drought in the Concord area affected your crops, and has it affected some crops worse than others?
We've been sort of thinking about this for a lot of years, and Cooperative Extension has been working with us on risk management. And obviously, adverse weather events are a big risk for farms. So, you know, we started years ago developing water sources and the equipment to get water to the various crops. So we feel we've been really prepared for this year's dry spell, which really kind of began in May. And we started irrigating some crops then. So in terms of how it's affected us, it's been more a management issue and just time dealing with it. But right now we're feeling pretty good that, you know, all that money we spent investing in, irrigation equipment has paid off this year. So it's really more of a management event, and I can't think of a crop that the drought has really affected for us. But obviously statewide, there probably have been some crops that have suffered. But we're not the only farm that has done this whole exercise, and what are we going to do to reduce risk?
So it sounds like you do things differently than maybe you used to, Chuck. You've been sort of working on this management system for a while. How have farming practices at your farm or other farms changed in recent years, given these changing precipitation conditions that we're talking about?
Well, as I said, the first thing that we did was sort of invest in constructing ponds and a system to get water around the farm. But more of what we're looking at now is a lot of our vegetables that lend themselves to this type of growing system are on raised beds with a mulch that covers the bed and a drip line actually underneath that mulch. And so we can deliver water, you know, really accurately, really efficiently right to the plant. Right there. And in addition, we can use that same drip line to deliver nutrients, too. And it's a lot more accurate and better for the crops. The trade-off is it does involve the use of some plastic, which drives us sort of nuts. But we have shifted over the traditional plastic mulch that you see over these beds is now a biodegradable product called BioTilo that we can plow right in. But we do use this, you know, a considerable amount of plastic drip tube. And the other thing that everybody in the conservation end of things has been pushing us towards is no-till planting, cover crops, you know, organic matter. This is not news to farmers. It's always been, you know, vitally important to the soil. So by paying attention to your soil, you know, you can do a lot better job of making it sort of resilient to weather events.
That's interesting. So it sounds like you water a lot more conservatively or efficiently than your average person who, you know, with a backyard garden who might just go out there with the hose. You're really thinking about getting the best use out of every drop, Chuck.
You bet, because, we do have limited water, although, you know, we're feeling pretty good at the level of our ponds and the brook that runs through the property right now. We're always thinking about how we can, you know, more efficiently use water. And, you know, one of the drivers of that is that, you know, this water doesn't miraculously appear there. It's pumps, and that involves fuel.
Do you pull from the nearby brook?
What we do is, you're familiar with Concord. the reservoir in Concord, and there's now a pipe that connects it to the Kentuckook River.
I see.
And so it makes sense for Concord to pump water at a lower rate out of the Kentuckook River to fill a reservoir. We have one pond that we do that with. The problem with brooks is, obviously, they get lower as conditions get drier, and Hayward Brook just wasn't going to provide enough water for us all at once. So we can pump with a really small pump out of Hayward Brook and use one of our ponds almost like a big bathtub.
Wow, quite an operation.
We can pump it, almost 24 hours a day with a small pump and keep that pond full, and that pond delivers water to that particular section of the farm.
You know, we've been talking, Chuck, about how this year's drought has been just moderate drought, but I'm sure you remember 2016, pretty severe. How bad does it have to get before you do start to worry about your crops?
It would have to get worse than 2016 because we didn't run out of water in 2016. Now the orchard, we do not irrigate. And that's partly, we just haven't got to that part yet. But they're also their trees. These are perennial crops.
Right.
You know, they've seen dry weather before. It would have to get a lot more serious this year before we'd really start to think that we're going to lose crop or lose volume of harvest. I picked my first peach last night and the juice ran off my chin. It was like, great, we're good.
All right. Well, so you're not doing rain dances out back just yet.
We're doing rain dances because it's always easier when the water falls out of the sky.
Yeah.
We're not thinking that we're in a dire situation here, and I haven't talked to a farmer around the state who's feeling that yet. Almost everybody is spending a considerable amount of time moving water around and thinking about how you do things. But we're survivors. We're going to be here.
All right. Chuck, it's really good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
That's Chuck Souther again, owner of Apple Hill Farm in Concord. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. A couple emails have come in. Josh in Portsmouth says, Brian and his entire team at Portsmouth Department of Public Works do a great job when it comes to water conservation. Josh says, I'm a huge proponent of their toilet and washing machine replacement rebate, where eligible residential water customers can receive $100 to replace older, inefficient toilets and $150 to replace washing machines with high-efficiency, low-flow models. Josh, thank you for the email. So, Brian, this is really interesting. Some people might just go out and buy a lower-flow toilet or a more efficient washing machine when the old one breaks down or when they want to save money. But your city actually gives people a little bit of cash to incentivize them to do that.
That's an excellent segue. Perfect timing on the email. I don't know if I queued that one in or not, but I had this note right here to say that the day-to-day use is another aspect of what we, as managing our water system, have been promoting water efficiency for, over 10 years now, many programs. But our most recent one is this washing machine and toilet rebate program, because, you want to incentivize people to replace inefficient appliances. So two big users of water in a house, a residential house, are, number one, the toilet, which some can flush 5 or 7 gallons of flush with an efficient toilet that might use 1.2 gallons at the low end. So the city of Portsmouth, through our city council, we proposed a couple years ago to do this program, which gives people $100 to replace their toilet with a high-efficiency toilet, and the same with a washing machine. You get $150.
So how many people just rebate. Roughly?
We've issued over 1,000 to date, and
really?
We still probably have enough money to do another 1,000. So if anybody out there in Portsmouth or in our water system, and we're a regional system, so this includes Greenland, Newcastle, some people in Rye, Newington, they can they qualify to get these rebates. We ask for receipts, and we do audit every now and then. We make sure that what people say they put in, they did. And we're seeing, and we've also worked with the Portsmouth Housing Authority, and it's been a great thing. They replaced like 200 toilets. They're saving 20% on their water use, which
so in
is
the
quite
end,
significant.
People save money, and you from the city end save water.
Yes, and we've done analysis. This is something I've been working on most recently, You know, a lot of people say, well, just get more water source online. Well, that isn't as easy as you could think. Nobody wants to put a new dam in. Nobody, wells are hard to come by in the public water realm. And it is cheaper to save water than to produce the next gallon.
Let's go to Concord, where Lorraine is on the air. Hi, Lorraine. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hello.
Go ahead, Lorraine.
Hi. I wanted to find out if there's a way that we could change people's mindsets on having these lush green lawns and valuing them as something beautiful and spectacular. I know in Arizona and out west they have a lot of landscapes, hardscapes with cactus and bushes. And, you know, I like to see people turn their lawns into, you know, bushes and trees and maybe water-loving plants and all that, and just kind of change the idea, change the mentality that these green lawns are, you know, beautiful. They're not. They usually get a lot of chemicals in them. People spend hours and hours cutting grass. My neighbor just had one put in last year, and there's a whole brigade of trucks that come and trim it and treat it, and that's using gas and polluting the environment. My other neighbor loved it so much that she put in a lawn. She cut down three beautiful, very old oak trees.
Oh, wow.
And
uh-huh.
is putting in a lawn. Yeah, and putting in a lawn. You know, I don't see the point of it. One other comment, I wanted to remind people of the booklet from the DES on do-it-yourself storm drainage management is on their website. You can download it for free.
Okay, Lorraine, thanks a lot. And you touched on this earlier, Stacey, this whole sort of lawn culture that we have, in America, but definitely in this part of the country for sure, where we have, you know, readily available water and things grow pretty well because we've got, you know, lots of rain coming down. I'd love your thoughts on Lorraine's comment, her sort of let's start an anti-lawn culture.
So changing the culture is tough. It's going to take time, and we're going to have to make the new norm, replanting our lawns with maybe water-efficient shrubs, trees, plants, or even there's a lot more grass seed out there that is water-efficient. But there needs to be a driver behind it. And what we're seeing now with these more frequent heavy storm rain events are followed by these drier periods. And with those drier periods, we're just not going to be able to keep up with the demand of the vegetation that's out there that we're necessarily planting in our yards. So that is the driver. I think we have the driver there now. Getting the education out as well that, you know, a brown lawn is a dormant lawn. It will come back later on. It's not a dead lawn. And then we're also seeing municipalities now looking at their different building ordinances and new development and coming up with new restrictions on what can be planted and how much loam you need to put down. So how much soil with organics in it do you need to put down? Because the more soil with organics, the more water it holds and the less you have to water. So I think things are changing. It's going to be difficult. There are going to be those people that love their green lawns and that's the way it's going to go. But
most people want their lawns to look nice.
Most people want their lawns to look nice. But I think if I think about my neighborhood, I don't have anyone who irrigates. There's no irrigation in my neighborhood. But my next door neighbor prides himself on how his front lawn looks like a golf course. So he's not irrigating, but it stays pretty green. So if you take a soil sample from your lawn and you can send it to UNH for testing to know what kind of nutrients your lawn needs.
Oh, because he has really good soil.
Yes.
Or maybe he's irrigating. Knowing what you do, he does it when you're not around. Yeah. So you don't see him. You know, you mentioned the forecasts, Stacey. What are the forecasts for this sort of wet, dry, you know, drought, heavy rain series that we're seeing?
So the climate science is showing what we're seeing is what is expected and is what we're going to get more of in the future. So a big part of that is going to be adapting to these changes, these heavy storm events and dry events, which we can see we're doing. We're doing it at the drinking water system level. We heard from Mr. Souther at Apple Hill Farm. They're adapting with their irrigation systems. But I think also the flip side to that is we have to look at the issue behind all of this is the temperature is rising. So we know the temperature is going to keep increasing with as time goes on, just because we've already done some damage to our ecosystems. But moving forward, do we want to slow things down? And that's where the energy conservation side comes in. So we can save lots of water, adapt to it, but what are we also doing to prevent these severe conditions moving forward?
Annie, go ahead.
I think to zoom out a little bit, I mean, this is all part of a system that sort of is what's driving climate change, right? So if we are talking about increasing greenhouse gases, driving changing weather patterns and more heat and more weather extremes and an overall trend toward more precipitation, you know, lawns can be carbon sinks, so they can help sequester some of those greenhouse gases. But then again, the care you have to put into creating that lawn that sequesters carbon can generate more greenhouse gases than the lawn would save itself.
Like our caller describes,
right,
with the neighbor
right.
who's heavily investing
your
in
mowing
his lawn.
Or your fertilizer used, you know, leading to runoff, which destroys water ecosystems and that harms the ability of the lakes and ponds to help with the overall healthy water cycle, which can help drive global warming. So, you know, it's nothing happens in isolation here. And I think it's important to remember, you know, you just have to be a good steward of your land. And that can mean a lot of different things and be a good steward of your public resources.
Yeah,
well.
Even if your land is just your little patch of flowers or lawn or whatever. Real quick, Brian. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I would say as public water systems, irrigation is okay. Just be efficient and then also realize that if a drought comes and supply is stressed, you're going to have to, you know, accept that you're going to have to cut back on that use.
Okay. All of you, we could have talked a lot more. I really appreciate you coming in. Stacy, it was good to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Stacy Herbold, State Water Conservation Chief with New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Brian, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Brian Goetz, he's Deputy Director of Public Works for the City of Portsmouth. And Annie, thank you so much for helping us out today.
Thank you.
Annie Ropeek, NHPR reporter on energy, environment, and development. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.